One of the ideas that I think it's from a Shlomo Volbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, passed away about 5 years ago in Eretz Yisrael, who writes that the idea of our children is really the concept of a seed, and that we need to have the seed grow, which is a pretty basic concept. The catch is that we have no idea what kind of seed we got. That's what makes it really tricky. See, we think we're an apple tree, and we married an apple tree, so of course we should have a little apple seedling. And the great part of the way that Hashem runs the world when it comes to parenting is it really doesn't work that way at all. A, because usually apple trees don't marry apple trees. So you really end up with an apple tree marrying your orange tree, and you get a tomato. And I have no idea how to handle this. What do you do with a child like this? Like, I'm not like this, and my wife's not like this, and what's this? And it's such a simple thought, but it's so deep as you begin to raise your children and begin to see who they are, that the task is really not to form and mold that little tomato seedling into an apple tree, but to allow it to become a tomato plant. And it really requires us to provide the environment, not knowing what in the world it's going to take, not knowing how much sun it needs, not knowing exactly if it needs to be indoors or if it needs to be outdoors, does it need to be pruned a lot, does it need to be pruned a little. There are so many different ways to take a little sapling and have it fulfill its potential. And if you don't know what you have, you got to make sure you're doing the right thing. And it's a lot of trial and error. But I think I find it to be just a beautiful approach to sort of understanding this little ball of life that you hold in your hands, and as it begins to grow and you're trying to make sense of its behaviors and what it's supposed to become in terms of trying to figure out how to handle that. But the best we could do is provide the soil, the sunlight, the water, and the nutrients, let it grow, pruning when necessary, obviously, but and then trying to figure out what exactly it is. I've always enjoyed that. I just sort of opened up with that to begin. So let's get back into our love and life. First, just anyone experiment, try it out, check out how many times you used anger, threats, warnings, how many times you tried to avoid that. Is it helpful during the week just sort of having that in the back of your mind a little bit? A lot?
I do a lot. Like, we had a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before I walked in. I was saying myself, like, I kept a list. I'm going to go through a bunch of them today just as examples to sort of like work them through, which I find is the most helpful. I have like a list of opportunities that I had as well this week. And that's sort of the way that it goes. We found it sort of helpful, a little bit, just in terms of addressing or seeing what's going on.
We used a fetch room earlier today. And afterwards, I felt much better.
Great.
I got it all out, you know, and Hannah was going, Mommy, fetch more, fetch more.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I feel great now. That was fantastic. So, no, it was fun.
Fabulous. Okay, so what I want to start with, I want to go back over a couple things. We didn't really finish going through some of the basic steps, and I want to go through a bunch of examples and learn a couple more tools to make it work and to make it as practical as possible. One of the things which we've sort of been addressing, we didn't totally deal with, is that as much as last week I focused on the concept of these tools, of the natural consequences, doing the teaching was to really have the child learn responsibility, have them learn the consequences of their decisions and the value that there is in that. There's a totally separate value in using these particular tools, the love and logic tools, and that is us as parents maintaining our sanity. Now that is a tremendous value. Do not ever underestimate that. 90%, I'm just making up a number, maybe it's like 87, I don't know exactly, but of our parenting skills and our success in being parents is going to be our ability to maintain our calm, to be able to maintain control of the situation, because we all know how easy it is to lose it, how frustrating it gets. We're all overworked and overtired as it is, and when we lose it, we're really very ineffective. And I'll share a story. Becky Udman, who I've told you about, and I suggest you could look her up online and order her tapes. She's a big big into this. So she tells a story. I've heard it on a couple of different lectures. Her famous Marvin story, where she tells of a young lady, a single woman who was out shopping on a Sunday morning. She thought she would get all of her shopping in. It's quiet in the supermarket early, 8 o'clock in the morning. And she's picking out fruits. She sees coming around the bend that she hears, really, just wailing, screaming from a kid. And as the cart that she hears it from rounds the corner, there's a father pushing a car with his 3-year-old boy, and the boy is just screaming his head off. And the father is saying, Marvin, it's okay. It's okay, Marvin. We're going to get through this. We've done it before. We're going to do it again. It's going to be okay, Marvin. And she's not into this, so she decides she moves over to the bread section, and before long, the cart's moving towards her again, and she just hears it like getting louder and louder and louder. And she hears, Marvin, we're halfway through. We're halfway through, Marvin. We're almost there. We're going to do it. She said, forget it. I'll shop Monday. It's fine. No problem. She heads to the checkout counter, and before long, wouldn't you know who is right behind her? The father and his three-year-old boy, and they're checking out, and the child has not stopped the whole time, and at this point, he's like almost standing up and screaming, and the father's saying, Marvin, we did it. Look, I could see the car from here. We made it. We're not going to have to be back here for a week. Isn't this awesome? We did it, Marvin. It's great. So she finishes paying, and she turns to me, and she says, you know, I just have to tell you, I think what you just, I don't know how you did that. I don't know how you stayed calm like that. I think that was amazing. It's like, ah, he's getting all sheepish and embarrassed. The way you spoke to your son was really just amazing. How you were able to do that? No, you don't. I'm Marvin. Oh, I love that story. That's what it's about. Isn't it? Like, all right, my child's screaming. That's fine, but like, I'm gonna make it. I've done this before. I'm gonna get through. We're halfway through. We're gonna make it. And it's really so much about our ability to maintain that. None of us, at the end of the day, you know, look at our spouse as we crawl into bed and say, you know, I really love it when you yell at the kids like that. That's the way your eyes get. It reminds me of when we were dating. Remember those days? Wasn't it great? Like, none of us dream like that. None of us talk like that. But our days sometimes become that, and we're frazzled and exhausted. And it's us maintaining calm and control of the situation, which is critical. These tools are great for that. Even if, and I will say this, I probably said this last week, I'll say it a bunch of times as we finish Love and Logic this week as well. And if, you know, it doesn't work, and my kids don't learn the life lessons, and they don't learn responsibility, but you know what? I know how I'm handling the situation. Situation X is going to arise, and I have a problem. I'm going to take it, deal with it calmly, and hand the problem back to my child. It's going to be their problem to deal with and not mine. And as we'll go through the examples of how we do that, so even if they don't learn, and I have to deal with this again next week, and I don't get the sense of, yes, they're learning response, I don't care. Because I'm not going to get frazzled by the situations they throw my way, and they will throw them my way. That's what kids do, and it's great, and they should, and they'll always continue to do that. But even when people come in late 2 weeks in a row and I can't live.
We're going to do that.
It's just a matter of I know how I'm handling it, regardless, and therefore that is a tremendous tool. So we should enjoy the process.
Thank you.
So we should be able to enjoy the experience as opposed to being totally frazzled and worn out as we do it. So that's one of the reasons why I love this tool. I happen to think it often works, and it does teach the kids to think, and the responsibility of their choices make a difference, and it affects them and not us. But more than that is, it's going to help me respond, that I know wherever I am, whenever I am, I know how I'm going to handle it, and it's going to affect them and not me. And if they learn, great. If they don't, it's also fine, but I will remain in control. We'll be able to get back into that. Okay. I want to get into the, I think we were in the middle, if you have your sheets. I believe we were up to before setting up the house rules, if I labeled it that, something like that. Okay, so we're in the middle of discussing with the various situations where these tools come into play. So one of the situations was where we provide the choices. We need something done. You can either get into pajamas, you can go to sleep without pajamas. Your choice, we sort of create, do you want to go to school in your clothing or do you want to go to school in your pajamas? And assuming that we're okay with all of the choices that are presented, let them make the decision and let them live with the option. If they decide they want to go to school in pajamas and they decide that they don't like that option because when they get to school they realize they're the only ones in pajamas, that's fine. They'll figure that out. They won't want to do that again. That's one situation where we set up. The other one is setting up the rules of the house. And this is where it most often occurs. This is where the general basic principles of love and logic will come into play. Step number one is providing an appropriate task or procedure. In other words, we need to set the rules of the house. We need to let the child know the computer is not for touching. Hands are not for hitting, teeth are not for biting, whatever the situation calls, food is not for playing with, whatever the situation calls for, basically letting the child know this is the procedure that we're going to be using in this house, and not in a threatening rule, there's no anger, it's just this is the procedure. That's step one, so that you're clear that the child knows what it is that's expected of them. Step number two is sitting back and hoping or waiting for the child to blow it. Now, you usually don't have to wait very long for that. And you don't have to really, you can enjoy it. I think you have almost, you need to almost celebrate it, because in that is where the significant learning opportunity will come from. This is the rule. When I say the computer is not for touching, I expect the computer to be touched. Just like as adults, you see a sign that says wet paint. And what's the first thought that runs through your mind? Well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. I don't know. Let's check and find out. I think it's a pretty common thought that when you see wet paint, now those of you who don't do that anymore, it's because you probably tried it once and you got paint on your finger and then you were stuck. But like, okay, so you learned a lesson. Like, if it says wet paint, it's probably wet. But there's this like, really? I don't know. Does it, I think? So we sort of test. So our children also want to test. So they want to see. So the hope and the prayer after you set the limit is that the child will then blow it. Now, we'll talk a lot more about that in 1 second. Oh, we'll talk about that right now, actually. This is the most important thing. This is the most important thing when you hope that they blow it, and that is our consistency in the way that we respond to the rules that we set. We just set a rule, just said something, time to leave the park, time to get into the bath, time to go to bed, children, you know, little brothers are not for hitting, hands are not for whatever needs to be established. And then the child uses, you sit back and wait, because it doesn't take long, they'll do it. Which is what we want. Every child worth keeping, and every single of you have a child worth keeping, will do it. None of us have children that say, oh, that's the rule. No problem. Got it. They don't do that at first. That's not how we work as adults. We push our limits. We like to test. So do the kids. Give them the opportunity to learn. Not a problem. Happy that you tried. But we must be consistent. Must. Now, anyone here ever play the slot machines? We don't really have a casino so close, but if you ever played, how do they work? The slot machines. Why do the casinos have them? Why do they make so much money?
Random reinforcement.
Because it's randomly reinforced, correct, my psychologist friend, right? They're rigged that they will win every odd number of, I don't know how many, I don't know when, I don't know where, but I hear all around me slot machines, bells are ringing, people are screaming, and I know that the machine in front of me soon is going to be a winner. So I start playing, I have 5 times, nothing doing. Well, all I know now is that I'm 5 times closer to the big win. You want me to stop now? That would be ridiculous, because then the next person who comes, he's going to take all of my efforts. So you keep playing because you know, soon it's going to win. It's rigged that way. It's set up for you to win. You just don't know how long you have to play until you win. But if you play long enough, you keep at it, what's going to happen? You'll win. We often train our children to view us like a slot machine, and a slot machine is addictive. It's addictive because you can't in your mind wrap yourself around ever stopping, because you know you're so close, it could be the next one. Don't stop now. It's very addictive. And we as parents create a slot machine system in our home where our children learn, not because they're being manipulative, just because they're trying to figure out the system. Can I have it? No. Can I have it? No. Can I have it? No. Can I have it? Fine. Oh, that's how it works? Got it. Now, we just trained our child that even though we said no, they asked again, and we said, they got it. So all that we've done is we've trained our children to think, just keep on asking, I don't know when, I don't know how, I don't know if I have to kvetch this amount, that amount, or like this or like that, but eventually I get what it is that I want, and the rules of the world are just keep asking and eventually you'll get it. That is a frightening experience for a child. Frightening. Can you imagine if every time you heard something from a parent, you didn't know when you would get what you wanted? You'd get it eventually, but you just don't know when or how. Like, how many times do I have to ask? Do I have to ask like 10 times? 20 times? 30 times? Like, why would I ever stop? Because it might be the next one that I'll get it, because that's what happened last time. So when we're inconsistent and you set a rule, a policy, and then eventually you give in, and they could be on innocuous things like getting, you know, an ice cream in a store, but all that we do is we've trained the children that that's how the world works. Keep on asking, and you'll get it. And it becomes addictive. And you end up with very whiny children, because when you say no, they have no reason to believe that no actually means no, because it didn't for the last 10 times you said no. It just meant that I needed to do something else until I eventually got it. So I sent out a question this week, right? The homework question. Set up a policy in the home. I assume most of you got it. Set up a policy in the home. Homework is signed at night. Happy to do it. Mornings are too crazy. I get a question in the morning. 2-3 weeks, policy work. Just anyone get it? Anyone talking about it? Mm-hmm. Whatever, right? With my kids. Too many people need homework signed in the morning. It was just craziness in the morning. 3 kids out by 8 o'clock in the morning. Too much. So policy is homework signed at night. So one of the children comes over very sheepishly, like, can you sign my homework at night? And it happened to have been a morning that wasn't so crazy. It wasn't crazy. Could have easily taken out a pen. It would have taken 10 seconds to sign it. So I asked, what would you do? So I don't know if any of you actually had this discussion, but I did not sign it. And we'll get to exactly my response of how I didn't sign it. That's steps number 3 and 4. But I refused to sign it because that was the policy. Now, what happened in school? I have no idea. I didn't even bother to ask whether or not she got points off the assignment or she didn't. I don't know. I can tell you that 3 days later she asked me again to sign it in the morning. And again, of course, my response was, absolutely not. I'm sorry, I really can't. And of course, with empathy, and I felt so bad. I'm so sorry. Now, did she learn the lesson? I have no idea. Maybe she got points off. Maybe, I don't know. But I know is that when I said something, that was going to be the policy. And if it wasn't going to be like that, so then all I'm setting myself up for in the future is a whole lot of trouble when I set up a policy and I say, no sleeper on Saturday nights when you do X, Y, or Z, too late, you know, whatever it may be, all that means is it doesn't mean anything. Because if this policy, there are exceptions to it, then everything you say, there are exceptions to it. Now, of course, there will be exceptions to the rules that you make. You'll live life, children are children, you'll have different... But there's a general principle that the greatest gift we can give our children is that when we say something, we actually mean it. For example, has anyone here ever seen a parent try to leave someone else's house after Shabbos lunch? And the conversation goes something like, okay, kids, we're going. And like the parents stand at the door, the kids continue to play. We're going. We're 5 minutes, and 3 minutes, and 2 minutes, and then it's just like, they say 100, like you can, you're like just watching the scene, and if you've ever been the host watching this, it's just painful because you're like, please can you just... And they're just like going on and on, it's time to go, and nothing ever happens. And the kids really have no reason to assume that you mean anything because you just say it over and over and over and nothing ever happens when you say that's it. And then you'll start getting angry and you get the threats and the warnings and all that good stuff will happen right in front of your eyes and you could just watch it happening and you see the ineffectiveness of... This isn't working at all. So, first of all, parenthetically, I happen to hold that there's a very strong kiddish phenomenon. It's what I like to call the leaving, the parent-child getting one out of the house phenomenon. Now, the kiddish phenomenon, as I have coined this phrase, really stems from adults. This is how it usually goes. We're at kiddish. Wife is having her conversation with her friends. Husband's having his conversation with his friends. He's done first. That always happens. He's ready to go, makes a motion to his wife across the room, time to go. She gives something like, okay, 1 second. He's waiting around. Meanwhile, he's waiting, she's talking and yapping away. So he sees a buddy. So he strikes up a conversation, waiting for his wife with his buddy. Meanwhile, his wife looks over and sees he got involved in a conversation. Great. So she continues on, because why should she think it's time to go? He just got involved in a conversation. Meanwhile, he has nothing to talk about with his friend after a minute, but he's got nothing else to do. He's looking over at his wife, and she's going on and on and on. She's thinking, I got to keep this going, keep it going, keep it going. So he's carrying on this conversation, looking for things to do, because she thinks that he's busy, she doesn't have to go, and back and forth, and finally, maybe she stops, but he's in the middle of talking, so he's just ready to go, but she sees that he's talking, so she grabs somebody else, and it just goes on and on, while they're... I've seen this, I've experienced this many times. I don't talk to anybody. When it's time to go, you can forget it. You're not going to get me to say a word because my wife's watching and she knows we're done. But our kids do the same thing. We say, it's time to go. And so they're ready to go. But they don't see you leave. They don't see you actually, but they see you standing at the door talking to your host while you're screaming from the door, time to go, time to go. Now, how many 4-year-olds say, okay, pick up their stuff, walk to the door and wait for you to finish your conversation until they leave? So they're, while we're saying, time to go, time to go, time to go, meanwhile we're standing and talking, no one makes a move for the door. So they don't see anything, any reason that you mean anything, and all we've done is we've now just created another situation in which we keep saying something and we say it over and over and over. Nothing ever happens. And they learn, like, when do they finally learn that it's really time to go? When you get angry and you yell and you go over and pick them up. Oh, now it's time to go. Like, what were you thinking, Tona? I didn't see you ready to go. So there's an aspect of when you talk about, like, leaving. Like, actually picking up and walking out the door. You will find, try this, I'm not saying to, like, literally leave the house, but I'm saying, it's time to go. I don't need my child to lead me. It's time to go, time to go. You pick up, I start walking out the door. You will find more often than not, oh, that you said it once, time to go, you left. They will follow far more often than when they just see you standing at the door because they don't realize anything. But it's a lot about consistency. I have tried that at parks very often, by the way. And if you watch what happens, that's really what goes on. A parent will say to the child who's on the swing, it's time to go. Sort of waiting for the child to make the first move while the parent's sitting on the bench and to get off the swing and come and say, okay, I'm ready to go. The parent's just sitting there on the bench screaming, it's time to go. So I have very often, literally, it's time to go. I give them the 5-minute warning, the 2-minute warning, the 1-minute warning, and I pick up and I start to go. I don't threaten them. I'm going to leave you here if you don't. None of the threats. I'm not warning them. It's just time to go. It's time to go. I start walking towards the car, and regularly, oh, time to go. I'm never more than 20 feet in front of them. They're coming at me because it's time to go. You meant to, there's no fight. Very often they're not purposely trying to fight. It's that they're trying to figure out whether or not it's really time to go or not, and we often are really conveying to them that it's really not time to go. But in any case, the main thing is the consistency, the ability not to create where we say one thing and we don't do that, and we give them the opportunity not to take it seriously because children are just sponges. They pick up everything from us, and they try to learn what they should and shouldn't do, and they see if we don't mean what we say, we've taught them to ignore us. And that is one of the worst things that we can do as parents, is teach our own children not to take us seriously. And if you'll listen to yourselves, if you, like, I try never to say something more than twice is a limit. And after that, then we'll slip into, well, what's the consequence of not listening? But to say it more than that is a terrible disservice. A terrible disservice to your children. Okay, so we're hoping that they blow it. So we set up a system. An example that happened this week, I'll pull one in over here. Sometimes kids come back from birthday parties with a goodie bag and there's like a whistle or some type of noise-making machine in the goodie bag. And I will not say in public my thoughts on parents who put those in children's goodie bags. What they're thinking. But now your child has come home with a whistle. Well, what's the child going to do with the whistle? He's so excited. He just went to a birthday party. He's got a whistle. Well, what's he going to do with it? He's going to blow it all over the house. Well, that's going to drive you crazy. Right? I hold any time any parent child comes back that we should send the child back to the birthday party to the house. Say, you deal with my child. Now, what are you giving a whistle? Okay, but that's what goes on in the world. That's what goes on. Now I have a child with a whistle in his mouth. Simple, no problem. What's the rule in the house? Whistles are outside toys. No problem. You want to play with your whistle? Great. If you're not in a home where they can play outside easily, bedroom toys, whatever, you set up the policy for where the whistle is allowed to be blown. I'm not going to sit there and control my child whether or not he blows the whistle. I can't do that. I'm not going to try. I'm going to control where he blows it. Whistles are for outside, for your bedroom, wherever you set up. Wait maybe 4 seconds. I don't even know if you have to wait that long because the child's still got his whistle in its mouth. And you just said whistles are not for the kitchen or whistles are... Every single child that I have ever had immediately blows the whistle one more time. Immediately. I have not had a child that doesn't do that. I mean, it's in their mouth, and they blew it, and you're like, oh, I can't have that. Whistles are outside toys. It's immediate. It is without fail. And I love, great, fantastic. What's my response now? Now, generally, we would get angry. We say, no problem. At that point, whistle gets taken away. Whistle gets taken away. And it's without anger, without anything. And as soon as you make a move, now your child's testing you when you say that rule. Just know it, he's testing you, or she. They do it equally. They are testing you to see what your response is going to be. Because if you ignore it, or if you just give them like one of those looks, but you don't do anything, you know what's going to happen 2 seconds later. You're going to get another whistle blow. and then you're going to start this power. I won't do it. I'll do it quietly. I've gotten it also. This quiet blow. They are so good at. You guys have seen this before? You're not just laughing at me, right? Right? They'll test it. You say, "Where's the blowing out of science?" So they say, "Well, I blew it loud. Well, what happens if I blow it quietly?" And they're just waiting to see what we're going to do. They're so good at it. You can give me this example from anything. So you blew it, and you're like listening quietly because you know it's going to come quietly. Immediately, the toy gets taken away. And that gets into, we're going to step number 3, but you have to be consistent with that, because otherwise you just set a rule, and they tested you, and you let them get away with it. Yeah?
So you're saying, like, with us, it would be like, you know, whistles are for outside. They blow the whistle. We're going to reach for the whistle, and they're running to go outside. They're
okay.
Like out the door, so... You take it away.
Yeah, I was okay. That's step number 3. Let's go. I was step number 3. So now step number 3. Now they've blown it.
Right.
Right. Yeah, no, because they're going to say, "Oh, I'll be good. I'll be good. I'll be good.
Right.
I'll be good." Right. Because in other words, that's really what we want from them. Because in other words, they're begging us. Tell me that you mean what you say. Like, tell me that the world that I live in is safe and secure. And when a grown up, particularly my parent, says something, it's real and they mean it. Their children are literally begging us for that security. I mean, can you imagine what it would be like in your job environment or with your spouse, and you never knew if they were really serious? I mean, don't us husbands get made fun of all the time? Like, our wives hate it. Like, do you mean it? Do you not? Like, what's the deal with this? It's a very unsettling feeling when you're not really sure if the person who you've put your life's trust into means what they say, and if they have to ask you 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, like, what's the deal here? So the children are begging us to be serious. So we just said, whistles are for outside, boop, right away. They're testing us. So that's what I mean. So I hope they blow it. Now they go over. Now step number 3 is teaching with empathy. This is step number 3. Now they've blown it. Teaching with empathy, love, and natural consequences. Now those are key things. Teaching with empathy and love. At this point, empathy basically means we're on their side, and we feel really bad about what we have to do. Oh, I am so. I wish you could play with your whistle. I struggle with this. If it sounds fake and phony to you, it's because I have to really struggle when I'm actually doing it. Especially now, I'm just like telling you about it. But it's. I really wish you could play. That whistle looks like so much fun to play with. I'm so sorry that you can't play with it now. In this case of a whistle, what would the natural consequence be? It's a fairly straightforward consequence. You can't play with it right now. Now, forever? No, certainly not, because the point of this is to teach children, you have a toy, these are the rules of the toy, I'd love for you to play with it. You just showed me you're not able to play with it according to the rules. I feel so bad. I'm not punishing you. I'm not with vent. Now, this is where I personally, and when I've seen people try this, mess this up, it's a vengeful grabbing of the whistle away from the child. It's with this pleasure of you violated my rule, you will feel the wrath of me. You've missed the whole point if that's what it happens. And that's the hard part I found personally in making this effective, is I'm on the child's side. I know you want to play with this whistle. I feel so bad. The rules are, this is an outside toy. Oh, but I'm going to, I know you will. Next time you get your whistle, I'm sure you'll be able to do that. I'm sure you'll think about that next time. No lecture more than that. Simply done. Whistle is taken away. Now, here you have to know your child. And you have to know whether or not you don't want to get involved in a race or in a fight to get the whistle away. So sometimes you need to be a little bit sneaky and let the child think they got away with it for a second while you sort of make your way over to the cabinet to take out a dish. You have to know your child. Sometimes you don't need to do this. It really depends on the child and the item. But there must be an immediate consequence. There must be one. But if you know he's going to take off and you're going to be running around your front yard in circles, you don't do that. So make sure you're in a place where you can get it, and then you take it away. And the child, "I'll do it. I won't inside." I said, "I know you won't. I'm sure you won't. Next time, you'll play with it inside." Now, generally, what you do is step number 4 is you give the task again, because the point isn't to punish. The point is so that the child learns. You set a rule. Whistles are for outside blowing. Child will immediately blow it again inside. Toy gets removed, and with empathy and on the child's side, "Oh, I feel so bad that you can't play with that whistle. That whistle looks like so much fun to play with, but it's an outside toy. I can't have it being blown inside." The natural consequence is it gives mommy a headache, can't have that, so I'll take away. Well, now, a whistle, personally, for me, I wouldn't, because whistles just drive us batty in the house, the giving the task again would be the following day. Because I'm just, like, not interested. But generally, it could be 10 minutes later. The child, you know, that's a significant amount of time for a child. And unless, and even the whistles are fine, because it should drive you so crazy, the child should be able to handle the rules of the house. Any child over 2, 2.5, 3 should be able to handle that. Give the whistle back to the child. I'm on your side. Here's the whistle again. Whistles are an outside toy. Or your room, whatever you feel is fine for the child to play. So it's with that empathy, and it's a lot of, when you say the natural consequence, a lot of, oh, I see you decided. You decided you're not ready to play with this toy inside. That's not a problem. I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to play with it again. So that the child has had it, got the consequence from what they did, and then wasn't able to play by those rules. You feel so bad, you wish the child could, but I see that you're not ready to do that with, or I see you've decided you're not ready, however you want to phrase this, that the child made that decision, and then you give it again. That's the key part, is being able to give the task again, and then see what happens. Now, most children, what will happen, most of the times what would happen at this point is, first the child would blow it loudly right in your face after you told them, and then when you gave it back, then they'd start blowing it softly. That's a real child worth keeping, would play that game, where they really got nailed on the blowing it loudly, and then they're going to push the limits to see, like, well, what really are the rules here? And it's just the same thing again, take it away for 5 minutes and give it right back. It's an outside toy. And generally at that point, they've learned, and that's how it goes. And you'll be amazed. They will learn that that's how it goes, but it's, the rule has been set, and I mean it when I say it. Just like when I said, time to brush teeth. Even just this tonight, I had the same thing. You know, time to go to bed. So in other words, bedtime routine is the same thing with the kiddush phenomena. If you're all playing in the playroom, and you say it's time to go to bed, your child will not make the first move towards his room. He won't. So if you're in the playroom and everybody's reading books or playing games, and you get 5 minutes of bedtime, everything is going well, 1 minute to bedtime, okay, bedtime, no child is going to be the first one to pick up and run to the room. We go first. Bedtime, pick up, I go to the room and wait for them. Now, if they don't come, so then however much stories they would get, there should be something which you should set up, part of the routine. In our house, we do a whole singing routine at night for them. It's personalized, which we'll get to a lot of them. It's like something about what they did that day. So they actually enjoy hearing us sing a song about something that they did. I'll teach you my trick next week, because Rifki made it up, really, so I don't take any credit for it. But they like that. But if we don't have time for that, so then there's no time for it. But I make the first move, and they usually, since that's something that they enjoy, so it's usually in their best interest to follow up, and usually generally do, yeah.
Might be off track a little bit. Is there a way to transfer that into the actual sleep? Like when they're asleep?
You mean getting out of bed?
Yeah.
Staying in bed. Well, so staying in bed is that same thing of just, there I found is just continuously picking them up and putting them back in. In other words, they want something. They want to be out, they want your attention, they want to be in your bed, whatever it is. So I found that is, for that, is just a matter of, there's no dialogue. In other words, you have to set aside, however much training it takes, whether it's a couple of days or a week, like when kids go to bed, it's not over the first time you put them to bed, there's another hour that's going to be involved, but they'll come out, just pick them up, and put them right back in. And they'll come out, and they'll go right back in. They get tired of that game pretty easily. They're not getting anything out of it. And if not, I mean, if that doesn't work, they like literally will spend an hour coming out regularly. I guess you could try some other stuff. But that's one of the things, like, you can't control whether or not your kid stays in bed. You can't. It's like one of those things that, like, you gonna sit there and hold them into bed? So it has to be, then we'd have to think about it and say, well, what's the consequence of the fact that my child keeps coming out of bed? What's a natural consequence that the child will see that this isn't worth it for me? So you have to make up something. This is where I find the creative juices in parenting would come in and be like, what would make sense for my 3, 4, 5-year-old child who continuously comes out of bed and I need to keep going back and forth so that I can't get done what I need to get done? What would make sense that it actually affects the child? I don't know if it would be like the following night, you know, not doing their bedtime routine because I expect it to take so long. I don't know if that would work so well. That's where the thought process would go. I don't take the time now, but like it would be, what would be a natural consequence that the child sees that it hurts only them for keep coming out, so they decide it makes sense for them to stay in as opposed to coming out. But you can't force a child to stay in bed. Think about it. I mean, I've seen parents do all sorts of crazy things to try, but it usually doesn't work.
And we spoke about this last time, though, a natural consequence is if you keep coming out of the door, then we're going to close the door and they're not going to be able to open this door.
Right, so sometimes that's why, things like whether or not there's a nightlight or the door's...
You get panicked.
Right, that doesn't always work because, in other words, a nightlight or a door open, there are all the things that the child likes where I can't keep this open if you're going to keep coming out. That's where the juices have to flow in terms of thinking about it. And very often, like, all parenting is hard. It's a question of where you want to put your energy into figuring that out. We could try to work that out. I don't do it right now, but that's where that would have to come in. Let me just bring a couple of examples. Again, this is just what happened to me this week. Just where this would play itself out. Now again, this is so my kids are as normal as yours, all worth keeping, and they do great stuff. Great, great stuff. So I did the signing homework at night. I did the blowing the whistle around the house. So I have a couple of boys that like to play football in the living room when mommy's not around with the boys. And so the way that it works is there are three of them, so they each get a turn. They get a pass from me. I'm sitting on the couch, and they each get a turn. Now what happens is some of the older boys like to play defense against the youngest one and intercept his passes. Now, no one was there against them old enough to do that, so they got the advantage of getting all the passes, and now they're stealing their younger brother's passes. Now, this as a parent is very frustrating, because here you're trying to bring up, you know, the little guy, and he's getting pounded and pummeled by his older brothers, and he can't do anything. All he does is he gets frightened. Now, the younger brother's now crying, goes, hey, I did that, right? You know how it goes. And the older brother's got the sheepish grin on. What do you do as a parent in this situation? Now, parenthetically speaking, by the way, I once spoke to Dr. Aaron Feldman, a psychologist. He does a lot with children. When I had two, and my eldest used to, I don't use the word manipulate, but take advantage, let's say, of her younger brother by like striking all sorts of deals, like if you give me your ice cream, I'll read you a book, kind of stuff like that. And I, as the parent, would be like horrified that my poor little two-year-old who doesn't know enough to defend himself from his older sibling, totally running him all over the place in what was in my eyes very unfair. So I remember speaking with him about like, what should we as parents do? Like she's giving him a choice, but he doesn't know enough to know what's really the good option, so he's always choosing the bad option. She's getting away with murder. This is crazy. So he said, don't worry, he's going to grow up and he'll get back at her. And it's fine. And you know, unless he's getting hurt. So okay, so he gets whatever. So he'll grow up. Like, you don't need, like, you'll have enough things to make yourself crazy over with the older siblings, unless she's doing something in which you feel she needs to be trained because it's like unhealthy for her to do that, or he's getting her. But generally, it's not. It's just, you know, she's getting an extra bowl of ice cream because she's being older than him. So leave it alone. But here I have a situation. I'm trying to play catch with my boys, and the older boys are continuously stealing the passes of the younger guys. So how do you handle the situation? So, and if you can't yell at them, like, what's the most natural response into the situation?
They can't play it again.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's very simple. It's when I would call out the names of whoever the pass is intended for, and all of a sudden, their name gets skipped. And it's my turn. So, I know, I want to throw to you, but I can't play with, I don't like playing with boys who don't play by the rules. Something along those lines. Which is taken right out of the book when we used to start playing cards with the kids, and one of them used to cheat regularly. Now that's a great one, because that's like kids trying to figure things out. That's totally fine. But how do you as a parent deal with the fact that you now have this, your innocent little four-year-old, a cheater? And you're horrified. I mean, just outright cheating. And she thinks you didn't notice. So how do you deal with this as a parent? Right?
We had that situation.
Yeah.
She was cheating at chutes and ladders.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
It wasn't fun.
Right.
So I don't want to play with you anymore because you're not playing by the rules. So I got up and left, and she had
a fit.
Excellent.
An absolute fit.
Perfect. But that's...
She broke a piece, I think.
Sure enough.
That's perfect. No, which is what I would expect.
And I said, I'll play a different game with you, but I'm not playing chutes and ladders. And so we played a different game.
She broke the board
after she calmed down. This was like 3 or 4 weeks ago. But
that is that's the response, totally feeling about like, oh, I really wanted to play with you so badly, but I can't play with people who don't play by the rules, which is a fantastic lesson for a four-year-old to learn. When do you want your child to learn that rule? Do you want them to learn that with you over a game of chutes and ladders, or do you want them to learn that when they're 6, 7, and 8 with their friends who are going to be much less forgiving than you are? Because their friends are not going to say, I'll play a different game, or they won't come back 3 minutes later and say, are you ready to play now? They're just done. Nobody likes to play with a cheater. So the greatest service you can do to a child who cheats, and all of your children should, Amir Tzashem, grow up and start cheating with you. That's what children do. They're trying to learn the rules. Just like they test you when you say it's time to leave and they push the limits and you say not to blow the whistle and they do. Well, the rules of the game are you only get to move 3 spots when you roll a 3 and they're going to move 4. Because they want to know what the rules are. And to set on, these are the rules. I really love playing, as long as the empathy is laid on thick and heavy, I really love playing with you, but I only like playing with the rules. I'm not ready to play right now. When you're ready to play, and that's all that we could have said, which is sort of what you did, when you're ready to play by the rules, let me know, I'm happy to play again. But game over, and then you can sit down with them. As a parent, you can sit down with them 3 minutes later and let them play again. Give them the task again, and you'll see that they learn. It's not fun. Who loses when they cheat? They do. What a fantastic lesson to learn with your 3-year-old. So the same thing with the football. I'm sitting in the living room, and their name gets skipped, and they miss 3 or 4 turns. And I say, I can't play with people who I can't trust to play by the rules. And that's the end of the problem. But again, they learn it, and I don't know, but I'm okay with a situation that I otherwise would not know how to handle, where I have an older brother stealing the passes. How do you control that? I can't be in both places at the same time. I can't be on the couch throwing it on the other side, protecting the younger brother from being allowed to get his catch. But you know, this works.
Yeah, but anything that the older kid is going to spill just have to, even if you're not calling
him. It's not because the older kid plays more regularly. There's always an opportunity where you're not going to want to play with him fairly shortly thereafter because of that. And remember, nerds, like, we don't need to show our control in the power struggle by threatening and overpowering them, but just speak through the natural consequences of, well, I don't want to do this with you right now because you have decided that you're not ready to play by these rules. It usually, generally, there always needs to be tweaking the way that you say it and how it comes out, but it usually I found it fairly effective. How did it work for you when you played the game the next time?
Actually, she did say, she said, I'm ready to play by the rules.
Okay. In other words, the children want to know how it works. They want to win, so they think it's in their best interest to do whatever.
She was really upset that I got up and left.
Right.
I think she was expecting that.
For sure not.
Because she wanted to play.
Right. So I'm like, so you need to expect, that's a great example, because that's really what will happen. Your child, when you take the whistle from them, will throw a fit.
Now here's the question. So the other thing she did was she picked up the board and started throwing it. I mean, she had like major meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
Threw the pieces
everywhere. She'll throw everything in the room.
Well, she threw the pieces, so I packed everything up and I put it up on a shelf.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's what I mean. When you're ready to play, I'll take down all your toys. The key thing is then giving the task again, mm-hmm. where in which... Now this
I don't think I did. I don't think I came back to it.
Right, that's the hard...
I was in a different game.
Right, which is fine, but it's that you're playing. The hard part is being on her side when you're putting them away. In other words, the easy thing, again, this is me, and maybe you guys don't have them, would be being angry when I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And that's very self-defeated, because when we show the anger... They take the higher, they can, you know, you always do this, you never let me do that. But if it's, I got you this game because I love playing with you and I'm so sad that we can't play now. And if you could really be genuine with the child in that empathy, as you take it away, it usually, everything is shortened and it ends up being much more effective. Yeah.
I think I'm having trouble reconciling, giving the task again and also being totally, consistent with the consequence. So like for instance, so tonight we were doing wash up time and we were brushing teeth with our oldest, and then I said we have to cooperate with brushing teeth, or else we can't do story time. And then he didn't cooperate. And then so then I was thinking, okay, so I have to be consistent with this. And then I went over into the youngest room and we did story time over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he threw a fit. He yelled, threw a fit.
Right.
But then, where does this thing come into presenting the task again?
Well, and teeth brushing would be the following night. Because that's a task that happens. That's a specific time and place with teeth brushing. I would say, and again, this is, my word is not like the word. It's just like, in teeth brushing, I would say that's a nightly thing. That's the next task is the following night. I wouldn't do that. Because once you blew it once, you can't give that task again that night, because if you get story time, then that's over already. There is no second task for that evening. but there certainly is the following night. Most things, like the whistle, you could, you know, here, you blew it, I take it away. I can give it to you again 10 minutes later. That's the kind of thing where it's much more fluid. Something which has that one-time effect, that would be it for the night. I would expect to fit. And as I said last night, many a child of mine has fallen asleep crying because of something like that, where that's just the way that it is. I had that thing with the kid coming out of bed last night. So one of my 5-year-old was coming out of bed. Everything else was fine, and he's just wired. He's in and out. So finally stays in bed for a long enough time, and then he comes out again, and this time he's got a complaint. His blankets fell on the floor. Kids are awesome. They're so creative. They're amazing. There's blankets on the floor. Can I put them on? So my mom said, absolutely not. I tucked you in once. If you're thrashing around in your bed, kicking your blankets off, that's not my problem. I said, I'm so sorry. You can put them back on. I put him back in his room and I left. And he starts screaming, I can't do it. They're too big. And he's screaming in his room. But that's it. I mean, I'm not putting his blankets on his bed. So he's been up for an hour singing and prancing around. He finally, now that he's crying, he fell asleep. So when I went in to check on him 2 hours later, wouldn't you know it, that he's got his blankets on his bed, curled up asleep on his bed.
So, you're not worried about him waking up the other kids?
Right? So,
sleeping on the floor.
Right, so in my house, no, at this point, that hasn't been a problem. At certain stages, that is. So whether or not that's a good one, that's dependent on your layout of your home. And this is where everything needs to be fluid in terms of if is that or is that not a valid consequence in terms of where is everybody sleeping. I would very often, the kids don't sleep in our beds. But certainly, they sometimes are allowed to fall asleep in our beds. But generally, that's reserved for the child who's being disturbed by the other children. In other words, if I have like 2 boys in one room, and one of them's yapping, 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 so I go in there and say, there's no more talking in here. Someone talks, I have to stand outside for a couple minutes, someone's going to keep talking. The other child ends up in our room to fall asleep. They hate that. But that's a natural consequence of, oh, I see that you're still talking a lot. That's okay. I can't make you go to sleep. But so-and-so can't fall asleep when you're talking, so I'm going to take him into... And everybody knows that's the treat. That's what they all want, is to be able to fall asleep in mommy and daddy's bed. So sometimes you need to move around other kids, if that's possible. And if it means putting a baby to bed in your bedroom so that the other 3-year-old can scream himself to sleep. That's sometimes where every house... The layout and the ages are different in terms of who goes to who. Let's say normally you'd rather put your baby to bed at 6:30 and your 3-year-old to bed at 7, but your 7-year-old's got a screen. This is what's going to go on for a little bit. So you know what? If you have to make an adjustment and you keep the baby up for an extra hour, put the baby to bed. Those are the things that you need to do. It's usually a short amount of time where they learn that. And that's where it's fluid. There's no set rule. It's a matter of figuring out what works for you and for your family and what doesn't work. And that's a natural consequence. Like my kids love sleeping in the same room as each other, but they can't be here because you're screaming too loudly, so they need to move out. But that works in my house. That's just a suggestion. It's a matter of, that's a fluid thing. You figure that out. Where are you going?
What if your child comes out of bed crying because she has to daven?
Oh, the religious.
And she goes to her sitter and she's like, Tati, I can't sleep, I have to die.
Yeah, so I've had some spiritual children who have pulled that one. So I don't buy that. I think that's the same beautiful creativity that a child has. So I've had that at my Friday night table with benching, where the kids are up, the younger ones get put to bed, and then the older ones stay up for a little bit longer, and then it's bedtime. And then it's time they need to bench, even though we're not benching yet, because we're in the middle of it, but it's time to bench for them. They're old enough in second grade and fourth grade, but they're not interested in bench. Everybody's still awake. So the time passes, and it's bedtime. So I take them into the bed, and they'll usually remember, just as they're getting into bed, oh, I didn't bench yet. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. It times out for benching. If you'd like, I'll bring you a bencher into your room, which is really not what they're interested in at all. But I need, and they bring halach. I need to bench at the table. Like, 6 years old. 6 years old. They know it. I need to bench in the seat that I ate. So, and if they're right, it's not gonna happen. Sorry. I really love it when you bench. But next time, I'm sure you'll do it right away. If you'd like, you could bench, you know, in your room here, so that they you know, give them a minute. So, if, in terms of she wants to daven in her bed, because I doubt she wants to daven in her bed. She wants to come out and.
I'm sure she just wants to be out. She doesn't want to be in her bed.
Right. So now it's a matter of, in other words, so that would be the kind of thing in which has she, where there's a policy set. Like once you say, like, oh, we said bedtime 5 minutes. If you wanted to daven, you needed to do it then. Now that it's already in bedtime, it's a little too late. If you'd like, I'll give you a minute. You can daven now in your bed for a minute. But certainly not to allow, you know, the religious excuse is just kids being creative. I mean, no 3-year-old is so spiritual that they're, like, they know that that's a task that they're allowed to do, and they know that we love it when they do cute things like that. So they play that card at the best of times. I mean, kids are real smart like that. So you want to encourage that and show them that you love when they do those kinds of things, but now is not the right time. And you can do it in your bed, or we can do it together, or tomorrow we can daven. And that's what I would do. I mean, otherwise, you know, you're just going to be, they'll, not because they're so spiritual, just because they're going to be very into that.
Right. How about if they say they need the bathroom?
So that's a great one. That's a great one. So I have a lot. The first time a child claims they need to go to the bathroom, even though I know that they did already, I've adapted this. I've experimented with different things. The first time I allow them, and if they are unsuccessful, and I know that they just went a minute or so before, and that's it.
But every single night, like, it's an excuse a half hour later.
Are they successful the first time they go or no?
No, they don't need to go to the bathroom.
Oh, not at all. In other words,
they
it's
don't
just
need to go to the bathroom. Just to get out of bed, but they so what
I would do is I would tell them to go to the bathroom before they go to bed. And then that's it. This is going to be the last time and really not allow them to. If they're not really going to the bathroom, like, you know, they've done this, then they really don't have to. And then you can feel comfortable that you're not sending a child to the bed, even though if they're good, and your child for sure is good, they're going to say, but I'm going to have an accident, I'm going to get sick, and you know it's not true. So you say, we went to the bathroom once, that's it. And you should tell them when they're going to the bathroom, this is the last time for the night, so that they know that that's it, that that's not going to be a way out.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a matter of, like, if you know already that they've done this, week in, week out.
But then, like, one night's
going to
happen.
All right, so one night it'll happen. Worst thing's going to happen. Let me give two other examples. Okay, so I had a great one. This one I'll share because I messed up in this one, so I want to show you how you can try to adjust midstream. So there was a football game going on in my family room again, and sometimes they play a little bit of tackle, not really. So the older one, one of my older boys got smacked in the face by the younger one because their heads, you know, line up where it's like, you know, that's what happens. So the younger one totally unknowingly sort of like, you know, moved his head back, and the older one took it like right to the cheek. Now the younger one had no idea what he had done. I mean, I was standing right there, just didn't chop that what had happened was that the older one got hurt. And my children are Baruch Hashem very theatrical, so the older one who gets hurt like goes into one of the, you know, like stops and like it's amazing, and then like has this silent wail where he's like, you know, he's like limp, and then he drops to the floor like a frog, you know, on his, where he's got his legs out and his face buried, and he's just like waiting for some major attention. But the younger one has no idea what he did, so he's totally oblivious. He's like, touchdown, because he's not paying attention. So he runs past him to score the touchdown, and I'm not giving it, like, I'm not into the theatrics, so, you know, that's a separate issue, but, so he's on the floor, pretending to be, like, totally hurt, and the younger one walks past him, and it's like this really, as he walks past, he sticks out his leg. Now, he's got his face buried in the carpet. He, like, just sticks out his leg, and the little one goes flying. It's like one of those scenes where you're like, I can't believe I just saw that happen. So, now, I lost it. I can't believe he just, like, take him out on the floor, and I said, that's not okay. And I take him to his room. Now, it's like 6:30, we're waiting for dinner to be served, or maybe Rifki had called him at dinner, so I put him in his room, and I say, I see that you're not ready to be out. You can stay here the whole night. No, that's anger. Like, and I heard him said the whole night. I didn't eat supper yet. Oh, man, I can't believe I just said that. I'm in the middle of this class. I said the whole night. Did I really say that? That's what I'm going for. Like, that's ridiculous. It's 6 o'clock. The kid didn't eat supper yet. And I just, so calm down. So I go back into the kitchen. So he's now out of the equation. He starts, of course, he's screaming in his room because he's pretty sure that I mean, he's gotten pretty much trained that, like, whatever the policy is, like, that's what it's going to be. Like, but he's thinking he's in there the whole night and he didn't eat supper, and suddenly he's starving in his room, and the little one doesn't know what hit him. He's like, yeah, I know, I gotta deal with you. It's one of those nights. So I felt really bad. So now this is what he's like, okay, you made a mistake. I'm not holding him to his room the whole night. That's just not what this is about. But I needed to take him out of the arena. That's not okay. He needs to learn that. So I went back in 5 minutes later, and he gives me his starving. He didn't get to eat supper. Can he come back out? So I needed to make an adjustment, obviously, because that first... So I said, I want you to stay in here now. When you tell me that you're ready to come out and you know how to behave with your brothers, then you can come out and join us. Oh, no, this is what I said. I needed to try to keep it in his hands, but make it a natural consequence as opposed to my first anger response. I said, listen, right now I'm a little nervous about having you at the table with the other boys because I see that they sometimes get hurt when they're around you, and I really want to keep them safe. So what I'm going to do is when they finish eating supper, you can come out, but I don't want you to be with them right now because I see that you're not ready to be near them. Trying my best to adjust it and make it from my anger getting him out into I want to keep them safe, and right now I see that you're not able to be around them. So then I was able to go back a few minutes later and ask, do you think that you're ready to come back out and join everybody? And he said, yes, I can. And so he was able to go back in. But that will happen when you see certain things that you can't believe you just saw. And as much as we're trying to stay calm and make it a natural consequence, but it's a matter of like pulling back, regrouping, and if you need to like readdress, like, what are you going to do? So, okay, well, it wasn't consistent. I said this, and I didn't get, like, life is life. We're parents, we're humans, and that's what goes. And I'm doing that.
I was just going to ask, where's the space, where one of the lessons you actually want to teach your child is sometimes I make a mistake. Human, we make mistakes, even as adults, and then I acknowledge and or apologize, depending on what's actually occurred.
Yeah, so this one, that could
have... So you're saying, where you would just say straight, where you don't have to sort of just say straight.
I made
a mistake. I acted out of anger. I don't want to act out of anger.
That would have been fine.
I said something that
I shouldn't have said. I was too angry. Yeah. That would have been fine there also, totally. And I totally agree. It's a great point that part of it is always, you know, making those adjustments and saying, oh, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I got angry at you. I'm totally in agreement. That's fine. I could have done that. I think I had it gotten totally over the anger. I can't believe I just saw him do that. But I wasn't.
Apologies sometimes like go with kids.
Yeah, I think that's probably why I wasn't in my mind with a 5-year-old that it was really. I thought it was better just to put it back in his head where he saw it as a consequence where I wasn't comfortable with him being near the kids, so that when he was able to tell me I'm ready to be near them, I'd be able to bring him back out and he could eat supper and not have to deal with that. Let me just give one other example. One of my older boys, 7, so he likes to come with me to shul in the morning on Shabbos, which is great, no problem. So we go. So right when we get to shul, I give a shir at 8 before davening. Right when we walk in, which is of course like 7:59, he says to me, "Oh my goodness, I forgot to eat breakfast. I'm starving." So okay, great. Now now you tell me. Like, what am I supposed to do? Now I can't. So generally, my usually this is where I have either before done this or seen where now parents, like, it's now my responsibility to feed my child, and I now am going to like rummage through this building to find something for him to eat, muttering under my breath the whole time that I really need to be giving the shear, and I can't believe you forgot to eat breakfast, and what were you thinking, and you know, but like none of that. You know what my response was? Oh man, that stinks. I hate when I leave the house without breakfast. I'm always so hungry. Hit it. And it, like, that was it. That was all that I said. And he said, and he was like, and that was it. And he was hungry for 2 hours until group started where he got plenty of sugar. But it wasn't my problem. He forgot to eat breakfast. It's not my problem to feed him, a child who's old enough at this point, who's gone to show with me many, many times, who knows, need to eat breakfast before he go. I don't even have the need to remind him. And when we got home, he said to my wife, can't believe I forgot to eat breakfast today, as if it was just like a regular run of the mill. Like, this is what happened. Is he going to remember next week? I don't know. All I know is that what would have otherwise been for me a very stressful moment, and I've seen this where like a parent needs to be doing one thing, but all of a sudden their kid did something where it's now their responsibility to swoop in and save the child from their mistake. Not my problem. I'm not really afraid my child's going to starve. He had a fine dinner the night before. He's going to be in groups in an hour or two. He'll be okay. Not my problem. So I hand it back to him saying, oh, I hate when that happens, or I feel so bad when that happens. Had he even, now what he could have done at that point is, looked at, maybe he would have asked me for something. I realized after that I had a fruit in the fridge I could have given him, but he didn't ask for one, and it wasn't my prime responsibility. He's able to learn on his own. I'm sure next time he probably won't forget, but it's just sort of my response to that is what allows me to keep my calm, and he was fine. He was fine. Okay, comments, questions, examples?
Yeah, where do you draw the line about, like when your kid throws a fit, that it becomes their problem to take care of the mess that they made out of their fit, other than taking them to their room, but the mess is still there, and they'll just, you know, like throwing toys, you say, throw, you know, I'm taking away your toy, but you can't take away all the toys.
I mean, in terms of if it's a type of toy,
you know, you'll see them throwing toys, and
they throw a toy,
but then they throw all the toys across the room. Like, yeah, you could take away one toy, but then I'm left with the mess to clean up.
Right, I understand. Like the orange juice example that we had last week.
Right.
Excellent. So in other words, this is also where you need to know your children and the mess and what's okay and what's not okay in terms of saying. Obviously, the ideal thing that we would want is for the child to have to clean up the mess.
Certainly, yeah, like it's not going to happen. You know that's not going to happen.
100%. So, what is reasonable? Let's see, we have three. What's reasonable? Let's figure this out together. What's reasonable? 3-year-old has a fit for a totally valid reason. You took away his whistle, which he was using inappropriately or whatever. He has a fit. All the toys are now out. Great. Anyone ever had this situation before? Okay, so now what's reasonable for us as parents to expect for a 3-year-old? With all of the toys out, what's reasonable for us to expect the child to do? So, the child really is not capable of cleaning up the whole room by themselves. Right?
And or is, but won't.
Okay, let's take about it. If they are capable, then we can handle it a little bit differently. But let's assume, you know, I would imagine, for most 3-year-olds, that's probably beyond what they're really ready to handle. Okay, but they made now this entirely massive mess. And, what's reasonable?
So I would probably make her pick up, let's say, 5 pieces. I know that doesn't make a lot because he has damaged the whole entire room. I have to do 5 pieces, and then I would make my daughter pick up 2 pieces to give away. Gone.
Once you throw them, you lose them. There's some sort of consequence, really.
I said, it looks to me like you don't care about your books. She did her whole entire bookshelf. I said, I want you to put 10 books on. She put 10 books on. I said, I want you to put 2 books, and they're going to donate her friends.
No!
I said, pick two. Should I pick them for you?
Or you want to pick them?
So she picked the 2 most like scraggly books and gave them away.
She likes when she has her temper tantrum.
And then I don't really give them away. I just hide them for a few weeks.
Now, let's ask, in other words, does she then, in that kind of example, what happens? Does she continuously throw the books, or is that
she
like...
She hasn't got her books in a while.
It's been a while.
So on some level,
that was her thing. She would go into her room. Yeah. She has literally 100-something books. She'd stick her hand in the back of the bookshelf and go, and all everything would fall off. And I would look at her and I'd say, spectacular. Looks to me like you don't want these.
Great. And he found it to be somewhat successful, that response.
She doesn't do it.
It's been a while.
Okay, so that's certainly something along those lines is an option.
I find a lot of times, like, you're the one that ends up losing it more than the kid. Like, you know, okay, so then, you know, I'm sorry, you can't play the toy, so I'll take away the toy, like one toy that you love the most, but that happens to be the toy that keeps the kid the most occupied. So, like, what do you do?
Right,
like,
okay,
I'm going to lose that. I don't want to lose that.
So the other option, another option, is if you end up cleaning it up, which is the other option, is then... And again, you sometimes need to manipulate the situations of what's the natural consequence of the fact that you had to spend 20 minutes cleaning up those toys.
Right, but it's usually after they go to bed, and then then they forget the next day that they did it.
Have you ever promised a child ice cream one day, and did they forget the next day?
Yeah.
Did they forget about it?
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes they just wait
in
a room.
Them in the car. Say, oh, and like pull in the Kroger and be like, oh, Brewster. Oh, we can't go to Brewster's.
So
then have another connection in the car.
So that's where you need to be creative in terms of, let's say, okay, so they're not going to clean it up, so I now need it to clean it up. What would make sense where to a 5-year-old or to a 3-year-old, like, because mommy has to spend these 20 minutes, something like that, that's not always so easy to find. I totally am in agreement that this is where it's sometimes very difficult as to what makes sense. Now, whether or not it's a matter of, and if you think they're really capable of cleaning up a significant amount, or at least helping you, they should at least be involved in as much as you are, they are, then it's sometimes it's just a matter of whatever it is that they, similarly with like ice cream after they come home from school, it's a matter of the playroom is still a mess from last night. When the playroom is cleaned, you'll be able to have whatever. And you just need to find the thing that you know that they're eventually going to be interested in doing. And that's a rare matter of you need to know your child and yourself, what you're comfortable with.
No, I've tried all these things, but I find that a lot of times that, like, the consequence, the parent loses out more than the child. Like, you know, we can't have supper until you clean up. You know what? Then.
Wait, why can't you have supper?
No, not the kid can't have supper until the room is cleaned up, because it's not pleasant to eat in a messy room. But great, so then they won't clean up, and, you know, then bedtime and supper time gets all, like, hectic because they decided, okay. And they're also not the only one in the house, so, and then the other one starts cleaning up. Who's going to make the mess? Like, a lot of times I find, like, when you do this, you end up losing more than the kid, and they don't care.
So I don't have a simple answer. That's really where, you know, you and your husband, you put your heads together and figure out, you know, what, you have suggestions?
It's just a false expectation that parenthood is easy in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
You're losing out only because you want, like, every time I go into my baby and he's, like, crying again, and I, like, really want to be chilling out in the other room right now, I, like, actually have some false expectation that he should quit it. Like, cut it out. I'm, like, chilling in the other room, but... You know.
It's a matter of that's where the energy comes into, like, what really makes sense, what's reasonable, and if it's, you know, if it's not keeping supper time, it's, you know, figuring out what makes sense until you're ready to clean up. You know, if you don't want to, like, take away all the toys because, like, you need him to have those toys because that's what keeps him busy. Mm-hmm. So then that's really where, you know, mm-hmm. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards, but figuring out what makes sense. This is the theory that he should feel was on his head and that there was some ramification, but it's not always so simple, yeah.
What if the kid's like, he said that he doesn't care. Like, he didn't clean up the toy. Yeah. He loves. Okay, if I have to clean up, I take it away. It's on my shelf for the past few days. I don't care. I don't want it anyways. You're not going to get dessert. I don't care. I don't want it anyways. Like, he doesn't care.
I know, but see, what you did, the mistake was that you really made a threat. In other words, the problem with threats, let's just go back to the threats, is what you've done is you've created a power struggle. You said, I'm in control, you will do what I want, and here is the threat to force you. Most children that are worth keeping, and you have a child worth keeping, will respond, you're not in control, I'm in control. So you say, I can't have this, so I say, I don't want it.
He didn't clean up the toy, and the consequence was he can't have it.
But you told him that he said he didn't care when you were telling him to clean up, or after he didn't clean up and
no,
it was taken away?
No, after he cleaned up and he took it away, and then, like, he just didn't care about it, and he hasn't asked for it. It's a toy he loves. He moved on. That's something he cared about. It didn't bother him. I kind of wanted to put the toy back because he loves the toy so much, and I probably will put it back soon, but, like, he didn't seem to miss it at all. He moved on. Like, he always does things. They don't get it.
So it's a matter of, in other words, this is where again the creativity is. Well, then that's usually the simplest thing, is just losing the toy. But then there's something else. In other words, what he's not treating the toy appropriately.
He didn't clean up.
He's not cleaning up from it.
He said clean up. He said no. So if we have to clean up, you're not going to have it.
Then
I took it away.
What if you gave it away to a friend?
Like, really?
You don't care about
it. I have
other
kids who love the same toy.
Right. Okay. So that's fair. If you're not interested in doing that, then it's just a matter of something else that needs to happen after toys are cleaned up. Let's say, for example, you did something along the lines of it was suddenly ice cream time in the girl's home, and all children who've cleaned up their toys get ice cream. And now all of a sudden he's not getting because his toys weren't. But you didn't announce it that way. It was a matter of, okay, time for snack, and you give out to the other kids, to yourself, and then when he comes with his bowl, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. Snacks are, and you could even set that rule up even beforehand, where you're setting yourself up of snacks are after their room is cleaned up, which he'll ignore. But then it's certainly not a shock when later, and this is where you can, sometimes the consequences are totally natural, they just happen on their own, and sometimes we need to manipulate a little bit as parents to create a situation where he's learning, oh, that's how snacks are, as long as that's not something you don't want to be totally manipulative, but if that's what happens, snacks are after the room is cleaned, then great. Either he won't clean up and he'll say, I don't care about my snacks either, so say, fine. In other words, this is where there's a dual aspect. One is my keeping my sanity of how am I going to handle a child that I'm trying to get to clean up and doesn't do it. And then there's a matter of actually getting the house cleaned up. And it's a matter of keep trying, what is it that will strike a chord where he's realizing that it's in his best interest to be responsible. So if it's not playing with the toys, he doesn't care. If it's not getting his snack, you know, you keep trying and looking for what is it that he is into that would make sense, that because, but again, it can't be the punishment. It has to be where it makes sense. Like, I can't give out snacks when the room's a mess. It's like, so where it's phrased in a way where it sort of makes sense. That's what I've found, usually have found something, especially if the other kids are eating ice cream, and forget it. I mean, I don't know any child that's able to handle it. I haven't yet come across a child, personally, where his siblings are eating ice cream, and to that he said, well, I don't care. So I haven't found that. You know somebody?
I was like that.
For even ice cream, you would say.
I feel like I was so stubborn. Like, we used to have spankings in my house, and everyone, we could line up and get a spanking for something, and everyone would burst into tears, and I would say, doesn't hurt, do it again. I remember, like, power struggle, and my father, like, he never did it hard, but then it got harder and harder, and it hurt.
Right.
And I saw the struggle, he didn't want to hurt. But I would say, I can remember that I felt the choking and the tears, doesn't hurt, do it again, doesn't hurt, do it again.
Right? See, this is what our kids do with our threats and our warnings.
Yeah.
It's that same power struggle, just without the actual
spanking.
Don't
care, don't care, don't care, don't care, don't care.
Right. So I guarantee you can find something where, and this is something where I don't know if you generally do or don't keep ice cream in the house, but it's sometimes the kind of, whether it's ice cream or it's chocolate, whatever it is, which is something which is not uncommon to have as a snack, something we know the kids enjoy, but this is and it's set up in the beginning. This is for when the rooms are neat. And if you don't want to clean up, fine, it's all good. But you will see that it's in your best interest to do these kinds of things.
Okay, for example, I took him to the supermarket, and on the way he saw Brewster's, and he said, oh, I want ice cream. And I said, well, if you have time on the way back and you're very good in the supermarket and we can get out fast, you'll get ice cream. And he was taking everything off the shelf, and it wasn't really, so on the way back, we stopped. Actually, I saw a friend at Brewster's, and I was talking to her. She's like, oh, we get ice cream. And I was like, no, and I really wanted a milkshake myself. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And I was so sorry because I wanted to stop and get some. And we left. So maybe, and he actually sat for a second and then got it. He's like, okay, I said maybe next time. But I think maybe you're saying if I should have got myself the milkshake,
yeah,
and the other kid's ice cream, that would have been much more.
Sure.
Well, I'm punished, kind of.
Yeah, no,
you know,
that,
I didn't want to stop, right, and get screaming, you know, like, okay, ice cream. But if I didn't go there, that far.
Right. And that's where, again, we as parents need to be fluid in terms of what, like, can I handle that or can I not handle that? Can I handle, and does it make sense? In other words, if it's a matter of, I don't have time to stop. In other words, if you set it up as a matter of having time or not having time, then it's hard to make an argument to a child that says, well, we have time to order for four people, but we don't have time to order for five. That's like a harder argument. Why is that? That's not a punishment. This is just like I'm just being punished. So it's harder to make that if you set it up that way of if we have time. And this is care. It's got to be how we set it up, because children, they don't have to be very old before they pick up on these things. Like, you said, we didn't have time. Like, why are we stopping at Bruce's? Oh, it's because we have time for everybody but you.
Using the other siblings, like, I would have stopped and I would have got everybody else ice cream and not him. It's taking that look at his brother and hate him.
So in that case, yes. In other words, if you set it up as we don't have time, the answer is yes, because he will in no way assume that that's like some consequence of his behavior other than a punishment. And when we get punished, we resent the people giving the punishment and the people who benefited that we didn't. That's why, in the example of the room, it's a matter of as soon as the room is cleaned, you'll also get. There's no resentment. I mean, there shouldn't be resentment towards the siblings if I make a mess and they get ice cream, and I'm in control to get my ice cream when I clean up the room. So then that's much less of I hate my brothers. It's a matter of, and now maybe yes, maybe no, but a lot less than in the sense of as soon. And again, with everything, I'm on your side. I'm hoping you'll be able to get, as soon as the room is cleaned up, you'll be able to get. And what I would do is you sort of sell, like, dinner, let's say it's 4 o'clock, dinner's, you know, ice cream is till 4:15, and then it's too close to supper. As long as the room is cleaned up, again, if you have a child that tells time, or that makes sense. But you sort of create that situation where it's up to him, and he'll make a decision that it makes the most sense for him. But if, yes, I would agree with you that if you were to have stopped at that point and gotten ice cream for everybody but him, in the way that you set it up, you'd probably get a lot of resentment out of that, because Like, that's just not fair. But, you know, if you got home and they got snacks and because, you know, you missed, you know, there's other ways to do that. But you do want to be careful, and there's no clear-cut rules how it always works of where the rest of the family doesn't suffer. Just the child. I mean, this is a tool. We're going to talk next week. I'm probably going to want to go fourth. If you guys can make it for fourth, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll just give you the tape. But if you take real hardcore love and logic, it can be really harsh. I use it as a tool, personally, and that's how I'm trying to present it, as a reaction to things that go on in the house. This is how to respond, to react, to put it back onto the child's plate. And then we'll address in the next week or so lots of other things to create the environment that we really want in the house. But the hardest core thing that I ever did, as far as a love and logic moment where not everybody else needs to suffer, but just the one child, we had, this was maybe last summer, a couple months ago already, on one of the Sunday mornings, we're going to some, I don't know, maybe it was like the autism walk or something, where it was like a march somewhere. And none of the kids wanted to go. I supported the cause, but I also didn't want to go and march for an hour in the middle of July for any cause. I'd rather, you know, how much money do you want? But please don't make me march outside with four or five kids. Like, this is that. But, alright, this is what we're doing. Okay, so we're all getting in the car. And one kid decides, no way, I'm not going. Child is old enough where I'm not engaging a fight of picking him up and getting him into the car because he's too big. I'm not interested. But he is sitting on the front porch in the chair. I'm not going. Okay, great. What do you do as a parent? I got four kids in the car. We got all of our bags packed up. It's already hot. And I have a kid sitting on the porch, just not going. What do you do? So this is pure love and logic, and this is the most pure form of it there. There's no problem. Called up a neighbor, and I hired a babysitter, who was able to come over, and who babysat, and it cost $20, whatever it was, while we were gone. I said, no problem, you don't want to go? I'm not forcing you to go. We'll get a babysitter. Rule was, I don't think he was able to do that too much, whatever, no computer while we were gone. And then, for the next five trips every summer, summer's like ice cream galore, like every other day, where the kids that were getting ice cream, instead of getting his usual small, he got a baby cup to pay for the cost of the babysitter. So that over the next five, I'm not paying. Why should I pay for a babysitter fee? I'm not making income. You want to stay at home, I'll get a babysitter. Who's paying for it? Well, my seven-year-old's paying for it. Now, he happened to have had money, my grandfather gave him or something. So I said, I said to him, would you like to pay for this yourself? Or do you want to pay for it through, you know, your ice cream? So he chose the ice cream. And for the next five times, now again, I wasn't ready to say, no ice cream for you, because that wasn't going to work. Because, what's Riffy going to do with all the kids? Like, all the kids go and he sits there. He usually got this size, and was going to get the smaller size, which was a couple dollars less. And over the next five times, then we said very clearly, this is in order to pay off the baby, because he was a little bit older. And so I'm not suffering with a kid who's going to mope and groan in the car the whole time. And then we're all going. So no problem, we get a babysitter, and he paid for it. Now that's like real hardcore, but you know what? I was calm the entire time. I didn't fight with him. I didn't fight with him when I came back. He didn't hate me, and he totally got it. He counted off how many times he needed to do it, and then that was it. And he celebrated when he got his regular size again. But it was a matter of, like, what do you do? I can't make this kid want to go. I can't make him want to be part of the family. Now, a one-time thing, I'm willing, personally, to have my child not be part of the family event. Like, one time, not a big deal. If it begins to happen more often, we'll have to readdress it. But okay, this one time, he's not going, I'm not willing to fight with him. But he paid for his own savings. Now, love and logic, if you read the books, they'll have you doing that, like, all the time. Like, that's like their classic thing. All right, no problem. You'll cover whatever the cost is of whatever's going on. But it's your problem. I can't make you want to come with us. And if I'm okay with the parent, with you not going, then that's what we'll do. Now, if this had been a family bar mitzvah, then that would have been, he doesn't have an option of not coming. Now, then that becomes a different story. That's very common where we don't have, there's no option of staying home. You have to come with us. Now, sometimes if one parent can stay home, that's an option. But if sometimes that's not an option, and then then a different situation of how do we address when the child's sitting on the front porch and it's not an option not to go, it's not an option to get a babysitter. That's a little bit more complicated. That's love and logic too. I'm not ready for that. But that's where there needs to, you know, like, do you want, you know, if you can't pick him up, you know, do you want to go screaming or do you want to go walking? But there's that's a little bit more difficult to navigate. But anyways, yeah.
When did you tell him he'll have to pay? Like, that was part of the decision?
No.
When you got back?
Mm-mm. I said, if you want to stay, you can have, I'll get your babysitter if you'd like to. I did not tell him that then.
So he didn't know it wasn't part of his decision?
No. But his decision, in other words, I set up, this is like another example, sometimes we create the circumstance, the choices, and I created the choices, and I said, would you like me to get you a baby? I said, would you like me to get you a babysitter? We're going now. Would you like to stay home with a babysitter? Would you like to come? He said, babysitter. I said, fine. Got to be, when we got home, and then it was a choice of, you know, we weren't really planning on getting this babysitter, that cost us $20. How would you like to cover the cost of the babysitter? Would you like to pay for it? Would you like to get it through ice cream? No, I needed to come. I prepared in my mind the whole way home. Like, what was I going to do to get? Like, that was. I'm telling you now, like, it's like an obvious thing. I had to spend the whole trip there and back thinking, like, how am I going to get a 7-year-old to pay for his babysitter? Like, what makes sense and is reasonable for a child that age to be responsible for covering $20? So that, I thought that was a brilliant idea. Like the ice cream, like it was, you know, like not taking it away in full, taking away in half, and it didn't end up coming $20. I mean, the 5 times that we levied as the fine, you know, was $5. But he got the point. He was responsible for it, and we haven't had that problem since. So whether or not, maybe just grew out of it, maybe just a bad day he had, I don't know. I was able to handle it as a parent in a kind of way, like, your problem, would you like a babysitter, or do you want to come with us? In other words, I needed to give him a choice in terms of what he was doing to come. He was staying home with a babysitter, but now, like, all the kids know, like, if that were to happen again, they all know what, like, the first time, he didn't totally know that that was going to be, they all know now, if this were to happen again, and we were to offer any of them a choice, are you coming with us, are you staying home, they all know what it means. Is it worth it to come, or is it worth it to, you know, lose out on your ice cream? I would not expect to have this problem again. But, like, one time we did, and it was a fairly reasonable price, I felt, and they got it. Yeah?
I mean, we were struggling with the whole thing of, so what do we do when it comes to like immediate emergency concerns? Like, Menachem Simcha, the 4-year-old, loves to pick up the 19-month-old. But that's something that we are concerned is that, like, that's actually something that could be a very dangerous thing. So we want to respond in a very urgent way.
Right.
So we've been saying up until now, like, that's immediate timeout. If you do that, you're going right into timeout.
Okay.
But it seems like from the love and logic approach that it would be like, okay, so if you're going to pick up little brothers, then you have to go to the other room.
Well, no, I mean, you're doing the same thing. You're doing the same thing. Right away, he knows the rule is not to pick him up.
Because the difference is that timeout, it's 4 minutes in the corner, whereas the other room, it's whenever you choose to come back into the room.
That's fine. I'm not a personally big fan of timeout just for 4 minutes. I personally would much rather... have the child understand that because of his behavior, he was taken out of the arena. Mm-hmm. Let him come back and try again.
He's going to get powerful enough as well.
Yeah, I know. It's like, does he like being in his room? Does he come right back out? So, of course he's going to come right back, because he wants to be with everybody else. But he should learn that, like, when I pick up the baby, I get taken out. And then, now you can, I think it could be a lot of people that would tell you to stay there for a minute or two. I don't know, I don't like that 4 minute, like the time. I haven't found it, like, productive where it helps. Like, I don't find my child, like, deep in thought, contemplating his behavior and whether or not, like, okay, I got it. I did something. This is my response. Let me back in. And I'm there watching to see what's going on. That's just my personal opinion. You can tell me if it works or doesn't work. I want to make one last point, and then I'll let you all go. It's almost 9:30. I'm sorry for keeping you so long. One of the things that we want to be able to do with this is to allow the kids to experiment, to make their mistakes, and to suffer. In other words, you want your child to pick up the 19-month-old once and understand, without being what we could call a hovering or helicopter parent. Like, we don't want to. We want to love our children enough to allow them to experiment and make mistakes. And this is what I was talking about when I said they're going to blow it, and you should be happy when they blow it. You should celebrate that. One of those things that we often do as parents, and you could sometimes walk around a room with little kids, and you'll see a mother, like, running after her child, like, no, don't do that, and put that down, and it doesn't do good for the child to always have that grown up in the background watching their every move, taking it out, checking it out. Like, let the child. Can you imagine your first day in the job if you had your boss standing over your shoulder? Like, that's horrible. Like, let me experiment, let me explore, let me see what this is like. Let your children do that without hovering over them. The greatest gift you can give, and I've watched this happen with my children after I went through this myself, is when they would spill their cereal on the table, learning to have it totally no problem. Here's where the towels are. Clean up. And watching their face. Have you ever seen your child look at you after they spilled? They're like not sure what to get. Like it's like maybe this like the worst thing in the world that ever happened, because we sometimes like we're on top of them and don't do that. Like it's fine. Let them learn. Okay, you spilled. That's fine. Have you ever spilled a cup of juice before as an adult? Have you ever done something like that? Have you ever burnt dinner? Like it happens, right? Like let them experience life in a way without having that grown up, that pressure that we are in their eyes like big people. Like looking after them and never letting them like make a mistake, do something wrong, right? Like let them do it. It's fine. And not to hover over them, to allow them to explore and to experience and to make mistakes and to learn and how to clean it up. Like it's a great lesson to allow a child to learn that and to know that we're behind them even when they make a mistake, and that it's when we're calm, when they make mistakes. I one of the biggest sources of nachas that I as a parent get is when I'm able to, and it's not easy, when a child messes up, spills something, when I like throw them a cup something, and being calm, when they look at me, they see, oh, this isn't so bad. This is something that we can handle, we can manage. I just now need to clean it up. And it's so relieving to them that they're not in trouble because they did what children do. Let children be children and just deal with the consequences. No problem. You spilled, you made a mistake, something, we'll fix it. You'll fix it, but I'm giving you the room. I love you enough to give you the room to be able to do that. Yeah?
We had a situation that actually was a spill, but it was on Shabbos morning. So my son climbed on my son's back, who was holding his hot cup of coffee, sitting on the couch, and so the spill happened on the white carpet, which got cleaned today, for other reasons also. But in any case, so there was like the issue of, okay, well, you know, we really couldn't clean it up on Shabbos, so we couldn't then say, well, go get a towel. So he had the consequence of, okay, well, you're not allowed to climb on Tati when he's holding hot coffee, because that's not safe, and it spills, and it makes a mess, and da-da. But it was, but like we couldn't have the cleaning up. So now the next time something spills, cleaning up isn't the natural consequence, because that wasn't the natural consequence on Shabbos. So, like, it's, you know what I'm saying? Is that, there's a difference in terms of what the natural consequence is, because in different situations.
Your son is probably old enough to know a little bit about, like, the concept of Shabbos is different. Right. So I think that would be a fine thing to say to him. You know, like then with Shabbos we couldn't do it, but in general, I mean, he knows that you clean up every other day of the week everything that spills, right? And just on Shabbos. I don't think that would be such a problem. I don't think to make that distinction. I don't think so. I don't think so. All right, that's my presentation of some of the love. There's more to it. If this resonates at all with you, as a tool, Mirz Hashem, next week, I'm almost positive I'm going to go for a fourth week, so if you can make it for that fourth week, great. If not, I'll give you the link.
And then the 20th,
and then it's the week after, whatever the next week will be. We'll do the Faber Mazlish, which is much more, I enjoy that stuff much. I think that stuff, this is great. I find this is a great tool. I hope you find, if any questions, I'm happy to address it. I happen to enjoy it. I hope you find it successful. I'd love to hear any feedback if you do, or stories. I'll add it into next routine. Great stories from your kids and stuff. And we'll get together next week. Yes.